LibroFM lets you purchase audiobooks directly from your favorite local bookstore. Choose from more than 150,000 audiobooks, including New York Times bestsellers and recommendations from booksellers around the country. With LibroFM, you'll get the same audiobooks at the same price as the largest audiobook company out there. You know what one we're talking about, but you'll be part of a much different story, one that supports community.
If you're new to audiobooks, they're the perfect way to get more books into your busy life. Listen while doing chores, walking the dog, or just relaxing at home. All you need is a smartphone and the free LibroFM app.
If you already love audiobooks and don't know what to listen to next, check out recommendations and curated lists from the people who know audiobooks best, local booksellers.
Listeners of the Bookstore Podcast can get a 2-month audiobook membership for the price of 1 month.
Go to Libro.fm, that's LIBRO.FM, and enter bookstore at checkout. With each listen, take pride in knowing that you're supporting local bookstores.
Welcome to the Bookstore.
It's like a book club, but we actually read the book.
I'm Becca.
And I am Corinne. This week, we've got a lot of book news to work through. Some of it's older news. Everything feels like old news because it seems like every news day is 100 years worth of news. But there's been a lot of relevant stuff happening in the book world, especially after what seems like months of like coronavirus slowdown stuff. So
yeah.
We just figured we'd cover some of it, even if it's like a month old. Partially because our last mini episode was an episode that Becca did with a librarian friend, and it's very good, and you should listen to that too if you haven't yet. But we're just here to catch up. So should we get started?
Yeah.
And where should we get started?
Well, we can start with maybe what would be kind of the oldest news, I think.
Sure.
I don't even know how to say it.
Well, okay. I mean, we, like, as the podcast and stuff, and I think, you know, the book world at large definitely encouraged people to order books from Black-owned bookstores, which is an important thing to do. I mean, it's something that we should have been doing all along, is supporting locally owned and Black-owned bookstores, but it has kind of resulted in a huge, huge, huge influx in these stores' businesses. And there has been a little bit of Karen-ing going on in terms of this. I think just to say this, and we've posted about it in other places too, but like when you order from an independent bookstore, you're ordering from a store that's maybe operating on a staff of like 1 to 15 employees. Let's put it somewhere in there. Some independent bookstores are bigger than that, but a lot of them are very, very small. So if we're looking at like a 400% increase in the number of orders that a store is dealing with, that's a huge deal. And I think probably a lot of these stores are dealing with many, many more orders than that. So just, I think we're probably talking to people who are decent and nice to customer service folks, because we understand how those jobs work. But like, just keep in mind that the way that bookstore supply chains work, they can't just like go out back and print new copies of things. I can't remember exactly what it was, but I had read that like, I think like How to Be an Anti-Racist was in like its 15th printing. These things take time, especially like when all copies have been sold already. You know, books are obviously constantly being printed just for the first time around. So when something needs to go back for a reprint, it has to get in line behind other things that need to be printed. So like, these things take time. You need to be patient as a consumer who is trying to consume things more ethically.
And a lot of places are shut down because of coronavirus or are working on very limited staff. I'm sure a lot of these bookstores are actually just one or two people are going into the store and seeing if they have it. They don't have a warehouse of books. I think a big misconception, and anybody who has worked in retail would know, is that I promise you, retail workers are not hiding things in the back. This goes with any store, anything you buy. Workers are not hiding things just to make you mad. They would love to sell you stuff.
I mean, and also on top of that, like, I'm going to assume that a lot of the people ordering things from these stores are white, or at least just not Black. But you gotta examine your privilege in these situations too. Yeah.
I mean, it's just like anything. At a certain point, McDonald's is going to run out of breakfast burritos if every mm-hmm. single person orders one. And so right now, every single person is ordering the same, what, 5 books?
Right.
So we're going to run out. And yes. Yeah, I know we're preaching to the choir here, but we're just venting.
I'm imagining that, like, in some ways, the extra business is probably considered a blessing to these stores that were already hit hard by COVID shutdowns and stuff like mm-hmm. that. But on the other hand, like I've said before, it's got to suck that it's because, like, a man died and the cops can't stop killing people. That's probably incredibly painful to deal with. And also, like, that it's these books that, you know, it is work that needs to be done, but it's probably a bummer that it's, like, for this reason. So keep that in mind and just remember to keep shopping from these stores. Like, don't let this be just a thing that happened in June of 2020. Like, spread out your money to these places and buy other books too.
Yeah, buy black romance, buy yes. black fantasy and mystery thriller, you know? Don't just stick with the anti-racist nonfiction, as good as it is, you know?
Right, yeah. So we just thought we'd cover that. If you find out that somebody you know is, like, getting mad at some bookstore somewhere, just, you know, gently say to them that it's not Amazon. So, you know, it takes time. Be patient.
And also, like, let's all be honest with ourselves. Are you really going to start reading that book immediately?
Right.
No, you're not.
And even if you do, it doesn't make you fixed.
Right.
You know, it doesn't fix the world's problems. Like, you reading this book isn't going to solve racism. So it's just part of a larger practice. And part of that practice can be being patient.
Right.
All right. Now that we're all on the same page, we'll move into other nonsense that's been happening on the internet.
So the Booker Prize, I would say, are pretty big fans of the Booker Prize. I love the International Booker. I think mm-hmm. the books they pick are just really good. It introduces me to a lot of books that I would have never been able to find in any other avenue.
Right.
So the Booker Prize has, like, various honorary positions in the organization. And one of these is Honorary Vice President Baroness, which, I hate saying people's titles like that. Baroness Emma Nicholson. So I don't know how she got an honorary position. I think, like, her husband helped start the Booker Foundation, something like that. But Nicholson is also a member of the House of Lords. And she voted against marriage equality in 2013.
Cool.
Can't tell you that I understand how the British government works, but it is my understanding that the House of Lords members are appointed instead of elected. I think some of them might be hereditary positions.
I am going to go, like, isn't it kind of like, this is, watch me put my feet, like, all the way down my throat and into my stomach and just, like, slosh around in there. But, so the House of Lords, is it, I don't know, maybe it's my understanding, and obviously my understanding is likely wrong, but like, kind of like a hangover from, like, way, way back in, like monarchy times. I know it's still technically a monarchy, but, like, so you would basically, if you were a landowner, you were a lord, essentially. And so, like, that was how you got your votes, is because you had money.
Yes. And
it's,
I don't
kind of
know,
like, caucuses in the U.S. Like, caucuses were, like, only wealthy landowners got to vote, right?
Yes.
Something like that. So it's bullshit.
I don't know how much people. Different it is now, because I think a bunch of them are just, like, bishops of the Church of England. I don't really. I don't really understand.
I was thinking it was, like, you did something and now you've been knighted or whatever, and now you get.
I think, yes, you might be right, too, because I think they're appointed by the monarch, which is Queen Elizabeth, which is, like, not elected. Anyway, no judgment. I mean, a lot of judgment, but like, I understand, like, I can't really judge.
Well, we didn't invent government, so.
right. So the House of Lords, again, my understanding, they can't actually necessarily pass a bill, but they can like delay bills and try to get the House of Commons to amend bills. So they do have some kind of
some power.
Power, yeah. But not as much as the actual elected representatives. So anyway, so 2013, she voted against marriage equality, and she still has this honorary vice president position. So recently on Twitter, she tweeted out some transphobic things. She misgendered a trans woman and said some other things that I don't care to go into because they don't deserve to be repeated. And she is actually the founder, along with J.K. Rowling, of a children's charity. So people, when they saw her tweet these things, got very, very upset, because it's really easy to go on the Booker Prize's website and find she's a vice president. Mm-hmm. And so people questioned the Booker Prize. And, you know, I might have tweeted some angry things as well. but anyway, at first, the Booker Prize puts out this statement and says, Baroness Nicholson is only an honorary vice president. She doesn't have anything to do with choosing the book. She doesn't do anything with choosing the winner. She's just like has this honorary position, and her views are her own. She speaks for herself. She doesn't speak for the Booker Prize, which is very like a nothing statement.
I just like, why have honorary positions?
Right. And I mean,
like, just to make rich people feel even better about them being rich or whatever. Like, cool, right. I guess. Right.
And they knew what she was like, because you knew she voted in 2013 against marriage equality. Why are you honoring this person at all? I don't care whether she chooses. I mean, I would care way more, of course. It'd be terrible if she chose the books. But why are you even doing this at all? And so then people got, of course, even more mad, because the Booker Prize doesn't say anything like we support trans people or anything like that. And I think for me, it's a bit weird, because I think transphobia in the UK is very different than transphobia in the US. And so I wonder if the Booker Prize is more hesitant to say something about it.
Well, in what ways do you think it's different?
Well, because it comes from a feminist perspective. So transphobes here in the US are pretty much all going to be coming from conservative, this is gonna, you know, Republican kind of thing. Over there, they have this weird idea that they're like, I think it's helping turfy. Lesbians or saving, right, exactly.
Yeah. Which
they think they're protecting women as feminists.
Yes. Yeah. That's the whole, like, J.K. Rowling thing.
So then the Booker Prize comes out and eliminates all honorary positions, which is just, I mean, okay, well, you're still not saying anything.
Right.
you refuse to have a spine.
It's just kind of like saying, if we get rid of this position, we'll avoid these in the future.
Yeah.
Without, like, actually addressing anything. It seems more like a future preventative. Yeah.
And I'm sure, I'm just imagining things happen behind closed doors, but I'm like, for sure, the Booker Prize, whoever is really in charge of it, doesn't want to anger the Baroness and her rich and powerful friends. So as a compromise, they're telling her, you know, we're just going to eliminate all honorary positions. Sorry, you know.
Yeah.
That's what I imagine happens, because else, why wouldn't you just kick her out?
Right. Also, like, if the honorary positions mean nothing, I guess I'm just circling back to, like, why even have them? What's the point? Yeah.
Right. And that's why I feel it's just to make this rich lady happy or feel special, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't understand.
I don't either. In further book award news recently and scandals, I don't know exactly what to call this one. The National Book Critics Circle Award and the committee and organization itself has kind of had a shake up over the last month or so. So the info for this comes mostly from a pretty comprehensive write-up on Vulture that I'll post to, or I'll post the link to in the show notes and on the website. It was published on the 16th of June. So this isn't the newest information. And most of the events that are written about in the article happened like the week before that. So we're about a month out from these happenings. So you maybe have heard of the National Book Critics Circle Award. It's an award put on by the National Book Critics Circle, which is a professional association of book reviewers and critics. It totals roughly like 400 members, and they're mostly known for their yearly literary award, as it would be implied. It's started in 1975, and the awards are presented in March of every year. The 2019 Fiction Prize went to Edwige Dendika for Everything Inside, and the Nonfiction Prize went to Say Nothing, The True Story of Murder and Memory in Northern Ireland by Patrick Radden Keefe. But more recently, they have been in the news because more than half of their 24 board members resigned after quote-unquote disputes about how to reckon with bias and racism in the book industry. So earlier in June, 12 board members began drafting a statement in support of Black Lives Matter, acknowledging the racism that exists in the industry, and that as part of the book industry, because they are book reviewers and critics, they were culpable and needed to do better. So, like, for example, part of like their statement that they had drafted was about how last year only 30% of the Circle's long-listed award candidates were not white. So, I guess the other way you would say it is 70% were white. So the board's president, Lori Herzl, who did not work on the statement, she is also white, shared the statement by email with the board as a whole to get feedback. And the reply from one board member named Carlin Romano kind of set the whole thing off. He's opposed to the entire premise of the statement. And the premise of the statement kind of was that reviewers basically can serve as gatekeepers for who is and isn't read, and that publishing itself already has a problem of white gatekeeping because majority white publishers decide who does and who doesn't get published. So his statement, I'll read some pieces from it.
I can't wait.
So this is a quote from his email. Of American book publishing, quote, "This is a system that is composed of institutions that operate with the full benefits of white supremacy and institutional racism," and, quote, "white gatekeeping stifles black voices at every level of our industry." That is, he is quoting from the statement, and this, what I'm about to say, is his response to that statement. He says, "Absolute nonsense. Equating American book publishing with American police departments, as this claim suggests, is ridiculous. Many of the writers cited in the letter's own list would never have been published if not for ecumenical, good-willed white editors and publishers who fought for the publication of their work." So, and then he goes on to say, "I do not admit any culpability. I do not see any erasure. I don't think that our prize lists are too white. The letter's own list completely refutes the claim of erasure. We currently have 3 African-American members of the board. What should the breakdown of the board be in a country in which 13.4% of the population is African-American? Regardless of that, I resent the idea that whites in the book publishing and literary world are an oppositional force that needs to be assigned to re-education camps. I myself have probably written more articles and reviews about Philadelphia's Black literature and traditions in my 25 years at the Inquirer than anyone living, Black or white. I championed Black writers in my book section. These claims above are bogus boilerplate. In my 40 years in literary and publishing life, I've seen far more of white people helping Black writers than of Black people helping white writers. Our list should include the best books, period, regardless of author ethnicity."
Yeah.
So these quotes came out because it was on a private email chain for the board. They were then published on somebody's Twitter. So the board member who, like, organized and suggested writing the statement to begin with is named Hope Wabuke. I should have looked up how to pronounce it. It's W-A-B-U-K-E. And then she posted this email on Twitter at the end of the thread about all of this, which she goes into. You should look it up. Her Twitter handle is just her name. So at the end of the thread discussing all of this and talking about how she finds the organization to be anti-Black and impossible to change from the inside, she resigned. And then resignations would then start flowing in from those who agreed with her and those who disagreed with her choice to air the emails, and then people who disagreed with the people who disagreed with her because those people were concerned that, you know, discretion was more important than racism or whatever it happens to be. All in all, that was 14 people stepped down. That's a lot. That is a lot.
Yeah.
And it should be made clear that there were three Black members. All of them have stepped down. But it should also be made clear that the other two Black members who stepped down didn't necessarily do it because they agreed with Hope. So, for example, John McWhorter, he's a professor of literature, I think, at, like, Columbia. He doesn't support her at all and kind of says that it's dangerous to claim that disagreeing with a Black person speaking out against racism is racist. And so he kind of takes a moderate stance on it. Ismail Muhammad, who is another person who stepped down, and he was one of the writers who helped compile the statement, didn't think that pervasive racism was necessarily the issue with the board, but that the makeup of the board, like culturally, was presenting a problem. And this is a quote from him. He says, because the board is as white as it is, people are not required to reflect on how their thinking or taste or their ideas of narrative are structured by their whiteness, he said, and it can isolate people of color. So the remaining board members after, like, a lot of these people left, were hoping that they would be able to remove Romano from the board because he, I think, is kind of a problem, which I don't know, I could talk a little bit about. So because Romano was unapologetically making the situation into some sort of, like, reverse racism issue and, like, First Amendment rights issue, but they couldn't remove him because the organization's bylaws require a full board vote to remove him. And then Romano caught wind of this kind of movement to wish to have him removed, and he started threatening to sue other members if they attempted to remove him by saying that he would make it very hard for them to fight him essentially in court, and that it would cost them a lot of money and it would cost him nothing. So the future of the National Book Critics Circle award and the organization as a whole kind of remains unclear. Ismail Muhammad, who was one of the people, the board members who stepped down, he didn't leave the organization. He's just left the board. So who knows if they'll be able to move in a direction where they can get a new board in there. But it just sort of seems like Romano is there to sit on the board forever and make it difficult for other people to, you know, try to affect change in there at all.
Well, and I think that's something that is important, is that, like, this guy is not that his arguments are logical at all or make any sense. I don't think they do, but he's so completely set in his ways and obstinate and threatening to sue people. Like, he is in a professional position and he is threatening to sue people. And so if you imagine this is what's happening on the National Book Critics Circle, which I personally had not heard of before, what is happening on other boards of other book critic circles, you know what I mean? Or other,
right, or
whatever
just board
else.
Rooms or whatever else, not even for nonprofits. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Like, what kinds of people are Black people, like, up against to try to make any kind of meaningful change? People who,
right,
can't even, who just, like, immediately threaten to sue to be removed from a board. Like,
here's the thing, like, this isn't just about this guy disagreeing with a Black woman who, you know, says that the board is racist. Like, it doesn't have anything to do with the disagreement. It has to do with the things that he said. For example, when,
right,
he says that most Black writers wouldn't even have a position if it weren't for white publishers. Like, that's so stupid. And it's,
yeah,
it's, I mean, like, it's basically saying, like, you should be thankful you're here at all. And that's not what we're working for. We're working for equality. So, like, that is racism. So this isn't about him disagreeing and him disagreeing making him racist. This has to do with,
right,
his disagreements themselves being racist.
His actual arguments,
yeah,
are,
yeah,
racist. Like, that's something that always just bothers me. It's like, no, the prizes or the books our award lists are so white because that's, we do it based on merit. So it's like, so what are you saying, that black writers don't merit these awards?
Right.
Well, I reject that. That's not logical. We know that. So it, following that logic, it has to be racism. I don't know how people don't get it.
Right. And in the Twitter thread that had the email, she speaks about how she gave like a, I don't know if it was a presentation or whatever boards happen to do. I've never been involved on one, but she gave a, some sort of talk about a black poet and kind of got met with this idea that like black poets don't merit enough, that they're not good enough. They're not as good as white poets. And the poet she had been speaking about specifically then went on to win the Pulitzer that year. So like, there is, I mean, it is a problem when people are saying things like about a specific tradition of work, maybe, that isn't as valuable as a white tradition in the same field. And that's, that is racism. I don't know who needs to hear that, but it is.
Yeah, and it's because, you know, the board is full of white people, so white people can't see beyond their preconceived notions.
So anyway, maybe we've talked about plenty of problematic award things before. So just, you know, like, you and I both like to use awards sometimes to help us kind of like pick out books that we might be interested in. But, you know, you need to keep in mind that these are chosen by people. And those people can be wrong and biased all of the time. So,
like, people like Carlin Romano, which...
Which, by the way, like, part of his problem is that, like, back in 1994, he reviewed some book for his paper. And the book, I think, while I disagree with the premise of the book, which had something to do with, like, how pornography is inherently violent or something, he decided to argue a point made by the author by, in his review, describing him raping the author. So, like, he is definitely, like, one of those... well, actually, kind of men who I think just really enjoys his position of being able to like prove you wrong philosophically or something like that. You know, he's one of those, you know, someone like that, and that's who he is.
Yeah, no, I mean, I love it. I love that men like that keep getting, you know, positions of status and power. I love it.
Yes.
It's perfect system.
Yeah. JK, JK, JK.
Yeah.
Anyway. One of the things that I wanted to add was something else that Carlin Romano said in his email. Oh, here we go. He's talking about like the percentages of or the statistics, like the statistical breakdown of different races within like the publishing world. And he says something like, not like, this is the actual quote, "We professors especially know that accomplished black undergraduates rarely want to go into book publishing because it pays so badly. Blaming this on white racism in book publishing is, to be kind, simplistic." So, yeah, that is actually a way that the book publishing industry gatekeeps.
Yeah.
If your pay is so bad that people don't want to do it, or they can only do it because they have like a bunch of generational wealth to get their foot in the door, then you are excluding people. Yeah. So, just wanted to throw that in there, too.
Yeah, which I think we might have talked about before, but it's always good to talk about it again.
Well, and it just shows, like, you know, like, him including that in there and claiming that isn't racist is, to use his own logic against him, too simplistic.
Yeah. One other thing he said is, like, he talked about the U.S. Census. So, he said... something like, you know, if it, he quoted, "a business that is 84% white, just 5% of publishing staff in our entire industry are black, and just 4% of staffed reviewers are black." And then he goes on to say, according to the 2019 U.S. Census Bureau estimate, 13.4% of the U.S. population is African American, blah, blah, blah. He gives other percentages. And it's just interesting that people always bring up census numbers like that when we're talking about trying to get more black people into positions more Hispanic or Latino people, more Asian American, they always bring up, well, we got to keep it the same as like the U.S. Census says our population is. But you never see any of that energy with the opposite. Like, what is it, America, 52% women?
Yeah.
You don't see these people saying like, oh, well, there's 52% women, so we need to have 52% of Congress or what have you.
Right. And that always reminds me of, I think somebody had asked Ruth Bader Ginsburg how many women on the Supreme Court would be enough. And she said 9 or however many people are on the Supreme Court. And it's true. Like, those things don't have to match like census data breakdowns. No. It's just a matter of like doing what's right.
Right.
So, yeah.
And actually picking what is good and what is the best instead of letting your own unacknowledged personal biases tell you that it happens to always be white authors' books that are the best.
Right.
Anyway, I guess we're done.
Yeah. Sorry if that got confusing at any point.
That's we a lot of information. Place, but
thanks for listening to The Bookstore.
If you would like to support the podcast beyond listening, you can check out our Patreon at patreon.com/thebookstore or rate and review us on Apple Podcasts.
You can find all the ways to contact us. We've got our email, our social media, and our phone line are all listed at thebookstorepodcast.com. Otherwise, if you're on social media, you can just search The Bookstore Podcast and we'll pop up somewhere.
Our next book discussion will be The Buried Giant by Kazuo Ishiguro. You can find it at your local bookstore or library and read along with us.
The Bookstore is a production of Awkwardly Social Media, produced by Becky Young and Corinne Keener. Technical and production support is provided by Josh Bourdon and Zach Titus.
And John, if you're out there, thanks for listening.
See you next Tuesday.
Bye.
Bye. Oh, yep. Sorry. This is going to be such a mess.